officially welcome everyone to Tabluin Seminar. My name is Jean Valance, and I'll be serving as one of the online moderators today's session, which will look at Superfund and renewable energy, promising futures for sites with a contaminated past. Our session today has been sponsored by the U.S. EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, specifically the Superfund and Remediation and Technology Innovation Group. That's the same group that I actually work for, as well as some of the other presenters. In just a moment, I'm going to turn things over to one of our first speakers, but before I do so, let me cover a few basic housekeeping items for those participants that are joining us for the first time. I want to remind everybody, when you signed up for today's webinar, you should have received a registration as well as a reminder email with a complete set of instructions on how to join us for today's live broadcast. That email will point you to something known as the seminar homepage, where you can read more about the events, find links to a page including resources and the slides that we'll be covering today. There's contact information and bios for the presenters. There's also links to previous SRI webinars that we've hosted. For now, though, you'll want to click a button on that page labeled Go to Seminar. Once you click that button, you'll be asked to identify yourself by name, and then you'll be checked in online and brought to our fully interactive Adobe Connect environment that we'll be using for the live webcast. Through Adobe Connect, participants will be able to sit back and watch in real time as our speakers deliver their talks. If you haven't picked up on it, I will be controlling movement through the slides, as will each of our presenters as they deliver their sessions. So if you're the kind of person who likes to page back and forth with the materials and take notes, I encourage you to download a copy of the materials, which you'll find on the seminar links or resources page now. We will be able to let participants simply follow along via hard copy of the materials and join us on the telephone lines if you have any technical problems joining us through Adobe. But I do encourage you to let us know if you have technical issues so we can troubleshoot them with you and try to get you on board to that Adobe environment. By default, audio is available online for all participants. That means you can listen to this entire talk right through your computer, speakers, or mobile device with a pair of headphones. If you have problems with the online audio, let's make sure the online audio is enabled. You should see a bright green speaker icon located along the top of your screen. If that isn't, click it once to make it green to turn it on. And then if you need to, you may need to check your local volume settings on your speaker or mobile device. If that doesn't solve the problem, we do have toll-free call-in information. I'll be more than happy to share the call-in number with those who need it. Just know that you'll be joining us on a global mute, and we ask that all callers remain globally muted to cut back on other audio disruptions. Questions and answers will be taken at designated breaks with our presenters. At that time, our presenters will actually have questions read out loud to them so they can answer them live via the webinar. However, participants, whether you're listening online or through the phones, can electronically submit your questions at any time using the questions box that you should see in the lower right corner of your screen. There's no need to wait. You can actually submit your comments and questions at any point, and then when we take those designated breaks, we'll read questions out loud on your behalf. You can also use that questions window to let us know if you're having any technical problems with the webinar. Today's webinar is going to be recorded, and usually it takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to produce a final archive. All registered participants will get an email as soon as that archive is available for free replay and download. And you're certainly welcome to forward it on to others that you think will find it useful. If you can't wait, you can check out some of the previously hosted SRI webinars that are part of our nearly 600 archive sessions on our Cluin page. Again, just a gentle reminder, you should see the slide showing up on the left side of your screen. To the right of that, you will see a few other boxes, including speaker photos and logos. We'll have some interactive related webinars. You can click on any one of the webinars and then press the Browse To button to open them up locally on your own computer. And then just below that in the lower right corner, our interactive question box, where you can type up your comments or questions here and hit the question bubble button to submit it, or simply hit Enter on your keyboard to send it on in. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. So let me turn things over to Michelle Mahoney and Melissa Friedland to kick off today's webinar.
Great. Thanks, Jean. I really appreciate you orienting us and getting the webinar started today. As Jean mentioned, this is part of the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webinar series. We have quite a number of them archived to date. And we'll show you at the end of the presentation where you can access the archives if you want to look at some of the other topics that we've covered. So we're going to talk about Superfund and renewable energy. And to get us started, we have Melissa Friedland, who is the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator here at Headquarters. And I'm going to turn it over to her to give us some opening presentation. I'm pulling up her presentation now. There we go.
Thanks, Michelle. I want to thank you all for joining us today and let you know that this is part of an ongoing celebration of the 15th anniversary of the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. And as Michelle said, we host these webinars as part of a quarterly series where we share the stories of sites and projects that are part of the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. And today we're going to be discussing renewable energy on Superfund sites and in particular solar power. I am pleased to be joined by Dion Novak, who is an EPA remedial project manager in EPA Region 5, as well as by Jeff Underwood, who is the developer of the solar project at Riley Tar and Chemical in Indianapolis, and by Frank Avasato, who's the project officer for Superfund Redevelopment. So for today's webinar, I'll start with a very brief introduction to reuse and EPA's Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, which we refer to as SRI. And I want you to know that SRI plays a key role in supporting reuse as a priority at EPA. And I'd like to share the ways that SRI can support site reuse before I hand things over to our presenters who can dig into case study examples that exemplify what can be achieved when stakeholders work with EPA and prioritize renewable energy projects as part of SRI. So Dion Novak and Jeff Underwood are going to share their experiences at the Riley Tar Indianapolis Plant Superfund site and the Maywood Solar Farm solar project at the site. And their unique perspectives, as well as the remedial project manager, will provide insight into how a renewable energy project can be designed and implemented to be fully compatible with the long-term protectiveness of a Superfund site. And after the Riley Tar case study, Frank Avasato is going to share about something we called regional seeds and renewable energy assessments. So I know that our presenters are excited to share their stories and perspectives today. Feel free to ask questions of them. We will try and answer questions after each section, but we may save questions if we think future presenters will address them or if we'd rather get in touch with you personally. And we'll also have time at the end for any remaining questions. So restoring, revitalizing, and bringing economically productive new uses to Superfund sites is a vital part of EPA's work. And communities have been reusing cleaned up Superfund sites for many years, and SRI supports communities' efforts to return Superfund sites to productive use. So our mission at SRI is to work with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. We work at the national level to develop policies, tools, and performance measures that help support reuse activities, and also at a regional level where we support specific projects and share lessons learned. EPA has always been supportive of site reuse, but our thinking about the consideration of reuse in the remedial process has evolved over time. And in recent years, reuse has become an integral part of the agency's strategic plans and goals. We found that when we integrate reuse into the cleanup process, we can inform cleanup decisions at a site to ensure that a remedy matches the intended use of the property. We can protect remedies in the long term through stewardship and maintenance of property and implementation of appropriate institutional controls. And we can open the door for local economic revitalization by attracting businesses, jobs, and jobs to the area. And we can provide important social benefits, such as ecological and recreational resources and community gathering spaces. And in addition, reusing contaminated properties can promote sustainable, resilient, and livable communities by advancing smart growth principles. And we support the use of alternative energy resources. We see it as an important part of America's energy security and environmental sustainability. So I think that there's sometimes a misconception that redevelopment and reuse cannot happen at a site until the remedial action is completed. But I want to be clear that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. So whether you're looking at reuse while developing remedial action objectives, when selecting a remedy, during remedy implementation, or even during long-term operation and maintenance, reuse can inform the cleanup process in a way that helps ensure long-term protectiveness of the site. When reuse is considered early in the cleanup process, a site is in a better position to apply the reuse tools provided by SRI for returning the site to productive use. We found that site reuse provides a variety of economic, environmental, and social benefits. We've seen that commercial reuse of sites can support new jobs and added incomes to a community. We've seen increased public revenue and property values at and around a site where reuse has taken place. And with long-term stewardship of a property, reuse also leads to better protection of human health and makes a site less likely to be a target for vandalism or illegal dumping. Sites may also provide recreational opportunities and restore valuable wetlands or natural habitats that would otherwise be unavailable. So through SRI, we continuously help stakeholders actively participate in the cleanup and reuse of sites. But the way we provide assistance has evolved over the last 15 years, and we started out in 1999 with pilot grants to eligible communities. But based on lessons learned during these pilot projects, we now have something called regional seeds, and we'll talk more about that later. But regardless of the type of site or cleanup status, regional seeds provide an important catalyst for communities to begin the reuse process. And many sites have reuse potential, but they remain vacant or idle because stakeholders lack the understanding of the remedy components, the types of potential future uses, and the key steps and players needed to return a site to beneficial use. The seed concept, which you'll hear more about later, kickstarts the process by bringing the right stakeholders to the table, clarifying the remedy and any constraints on reuse, and outlining the community's goals and suitable reuse options to pursue. The tools and resources available through SRI are critical to supporting the agency's strategic plans and goals and include the Reuse Directive's mandate to explore reuse throughout the Superfund process. So I just want to take a second and go over some of our tools. And one of them is the Return to Use Initiative, which aims to remove barriers to reuse that are not necessary for the protection of human health, the environment, or the remedy at those sites where remedies are already in place. So we work with regions to find ways for headquarters to potentially help address barriers on a site-by-site basis. And then we share those projects in fact sheets with the hopes of reaching other communities and site teams looking for inspiration or solutions for reuse questions at a Superfund site. And finally, we have something called Ready for Reuse Determinations, which provide a single summary document outlining that a site is ready for reuse. And it documents that a contaminated site has been characterized and cleaned up to the extent necessary for specified current or future types of uses, as long as the use limitations identified continue to be met. And we found that the use of RFRs has proven to be very valuable for dealing with confusion over what future uses are appropriate at a site, and they've been helpful in facilitating the public and private reuse of sites. So since creation of the Superfund program, remedies have been completed at thousands of sites across the nation. And in the 1990s, the agency began to notice that many cleaned up Superfund sites had been left idle and abandoned. So in 1995, EPA issued the Land Use Directive, which emphasized the need to incorporate a community's desired future uses for the property into the remedy selection process. And in 1999, the agency launched the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative to help communities return some of the nation's worst hazardous waste sites to safe and productive uses. More recently, in 2010, EPA released the Reuse Directive, which addresses considering reuse throughout the cleanup process. And this guidance helps the regions to consider site reuse in all stages of the Superfund pipeline and presents factors to consider when pursuing a change to a remedy. So this year, 2014, is the 15th anniversary of SRI, and reuse has made great strides. And currently, we're aware of over 700 sites supporting actual continued or planned activities. There are many different ways to reuse Superfund sites, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution to determining which reuse type will be most appropriate or how to make sure that the site is being best reused. But this slide presents the general categories that we can use when looking at reuse. And our webinar is going to focus on the last category listed, alternative or renewable energy. And renewable energy resources include wind, solar, biomass, geothermal, which are non-polluting, inexhaustible, and increasingly cost competitive. So today we'll get an in-depth look at the factors considered when planning and implementing an alternative energy site reuse. And we have a number of tools available to support alternative energy use as well as all the reuse types listed here. So with site reuse as a top priority, we work to conduct site characterization and remediation in ways that ensure contamination is not a barrier to the reuse of a property. You may be wondering why Superfund can be well suited for renewable energy production, and we have a couple of reasons. One is sites are located in remote locations that encompass large areas of land that allow for the space needed to construct large-scale renewable energy facilities. Sites that are smaller in size and located in urban and suburban areas provide an opportunity for renewable energy to meet the needs of a different range of smaller scale renewable energy projects. And renewable energy infrastructure development costs may be reduced as many sites are already located near utilities, water and sewer, and transportation networks due to the infrastructure requirements of past uses. So renewable energy can provide power for remedy components and at former landfill sites in particular, and on-site waste can serve as an alternative energy resource. So as our up presenters will share, Superfund sites can be an excellent location for solar projects, but every system and every need is different. So we're going to take a quick look at some sites where solar has been used as a remedy to efficiently and responsibly clean up the site, as well as some utility scale systems that are bringing economic benefits to their community while providing green energy. And just like there is no one-size-fits-all for use a Superfund site, there are many different sizes and types of solar-powered systems to consider. So I want to just talk about a few commercialized utility-scale projects, which is DuPont, Chevron, and Peterson Puritan, and then we'll quickly go over some remedial uses, and we'll talk about Pemco, FMC, and Aerojet. So our first example is DuPont, and the PRP completed cleanup in 2002, but operation and maintenance activities continue. And after successfully completing remediation at the site, and with the help of EPA and the Delaware Division of Natural Resources and Environmental Control, DuPont collaborated with Tangent Energy Solutions to bring solar electricity production to the site. So the solar project would be developed by one group but owned by Greenwood Energy, and an opening ceremony was held in December 2013. And in addition to the solar facilities on the site, which you can see in the photograph, you can also see restored wetlands that provide valuable ecological habitat. And much of the other site property is in reuse or continued use for industrial and public works operations. The Chevron mine is located in and near the village of Cuesta in Taos County, New Mexico, and EPA proposed this to the National Priorities List in 2000, but didn't finalize until it was proposed again in 2011. And in addition to cleanup activities at the site, they were constructing a photovoltaic facility on a 20-acre portion of the on-site mill tailings area. The facility has been operational since April 2011, and Kit Carson Electric Co-op is purchasing the electricity under a 20-year agreement. And as of about a year ago, the facility had already generated 4.6 million kilowatt hours of energy. Okay, and I am actually missing a page here. Okay. So this is Peterson Puritan, and today the industrial portion of the site contains manufacturing and warehouse facilities for six businesses, an industrial condominium complex, the town dog pound, and the town's Little League ballpark. And through these great reuses and continued uses, we've had some wonderful economic benefits for the community, but what's brought this to our attention today is actually located on the roofs of these industrial buildings. So Megawatt Energy Solutions recently began installing solar panels on the rooftop of the Dean Warehouse as part of a new lease agreement, and installation is underway. And once finished, it's going to produce 650,000 kilowatts of electricity per year, and it will feed into the national grid through a voltage conversion unit installed at ground level thereby offsetting other fossil fuel usage. And a second building will be getting a similar installation soon. And we're going to transition into some sites now where solar electricity is helping with the cleanup. We have a carbon-based treatment system for soil vapors and groundwater, which continues to operate, and a solar-powered energy system provides supplemental energy to the treatment plant. So the rooftop rooftop solar energy system produces 5,600 kilowatt hours annually, offsetting 3.3 tons of carbon dioxide emissions each year. And the City of Maywood, together with the Trust for Public Lands, incorporated the site into a community park, and Maywood Riverfront Park opened in 2008 with athletic and recreational facilities to a heavily populated urban area. And just for a second about FMC, while there's a cooperative effort to bring the site into recreational reuse, which is a success story because it's home to the model airplaners, where they could fly their planes, there's a 14.7 kilowatt solar panel system at the site, and the solar panel system provides 30% of the electrical energy needed for the remediation system in the containment and groundwater treatment facility. So this amount of energy produced per year would equate to enough power for four average-sized homes. And the use of solar also prevents carbon dioxide from being produced and emitted into the air. And just briefly, JET in 2008 began planning to convert a portion of its facility into a solar farm to help power the site's extensive groundwater cleanup program. And Aerojet saw this as an opportunity to reduce the company's carbon footprint and improve energy use as part of their parent company. Aerojet continues to operate on the Superfund site and also has tenants on the site for a variety of office, commercial, and light industrial activities. Aerojet has also begun the planning process to reuse portions of its site for mixed-use development, including residential and commercially transit-oriented uses. So now that we've glanced at solar on super sites around the country, I think we're all going to dive a little deeper into a recent and unique solar project in Region 5 at the Riley Tar and Chemical Corporation. And because the project's developers showed great leadership and used innovative thinking to develop a collaborative approach to reuse the site, they were recently awarded Region 5's first Renew Award. So I'll let our next speaker, Dion Novak, tell you a little bit more about the award and the site, but a big congratulations to all of those involved with the project. It truly deserves to be celebrated. And with that, I'd like to hand things over to Dion.
Okay.
Thank you, Melissa. Dion Novak, RPM in Region 5, Chicago. Hello, everyone. As Melissa said, redevelopment can happen at any time in a site's remedial process from beginning to end. In this case, the reuse idea and the reuse implementation came after EPA Region 5's remedy implementation at the sites. It doesn't have to happen that way, but in this case it did. I'm going to give you some basic site background information and some initial EPA developer state PRP stakeholder interaction information. Jeff Underwood, who's going to come after me, is actually going to provide a little bit more detail on exactly what it is that we did, but I'm going to kind of cue it up and introduce how this project came about and ultimately how we made it work. As you can see on your screen, this is a picture. This was an old wood preserving site that started back in the 1920s, and this picture is from the 1920s, and so you can see they brought in the wood on rail car, and where those cool old vehicles are is where the bulk of the wood treatment operations actually happens. Again, the whole site itself is about 120 acres, located on two parcels in Indianapolis near the airports. It was a coal tar refinery with an operations began on the southern part of the site, as you saw in the previous picture, in the 1920s. Active chemical manufacturing started on the northern part of the site in the 1950s and exists today. The current owner, Vertella Specialties, Inc., who bought out Riley Tar back in the 1990s, is currently making specialty chemicals, again, on the northern part of the site. So it's a little unique in that we have a site that's got active facility operations as well as historical Superfund remediation. They manage their waste on site, and the creosote, the wood treating operations, and their specialty chemical operations, which resulted in groundwater and soil contamination across the site that was subject to EPA's Superfund program. And again, just to give you a little bit of detail about around the site, there is residential to the north and to the east. There is also industrial to the east and commercial to the east and to the south. So it's kind of in the middle of a unique neighborhood. This is an aerial view of the site. As you can see up there towards the top, there are five red arrows. Each of those represent a what we call a hotspot, an area of elevated contamination concentrations that during the remedial investigation we studied and ultimately selected remedies for. There is a, and I'll talk a little bit later about the sequence of the remediation of the site. These five arrows, the bottom three arrows are where the solar farm was constructed over. This was one of the original National Priority List sites listed in 1984. The previous owner, Riley Tarr, began the investigations in the late 1980s. There were five records of decision signed for this site. The cleanup was split into five phases. The first one was a perimeter pump and treat system that was put in place on the eastern property boundary. Operable Unit 2, and that was in 1992. Operable Unit 2 in 1993 was those areas where the five red arrows were on the previous slide. We signed that in 1993. Operable Units 3 and 4, which was the southern part of the site, which was where the historical wood treatment operations happened. That record of decision was signed in 1996. And then a final ROD was signed for the site in 1997, which kind of summarized all the previous cleanup decisions that had been made and then ultimately selected an off-site monitored natural attenuation component for the off-site groundwater plume. Did an ESD in 1997, an explanation of significant differences to change the operable Unit 2 remedy. The operable Unit 2 remedy was soil treatment using low temperature thermal desorption. That wasn't as successful as we wanted it to be, so the soil that was not able to be treated was ultimately shipped off-site, as you see in the next bullet item, in 1998 to complete the operable Unit 2 cleanup. Also in 1998, the initial restrictive covenant was put in place by the site owner, which limited a portion of the site to industrial use. 1999 completed the physical cleanup activities, and a preliminary closeout report was signed by EPA indicating that the construction activities at the site for the remediation were completed. 2005, soil vapor extraction of an area on the north part of the site in the active chemical operations portion of the site, which again, doing active remediation within an active chemical treatment facility is a little tricky, but ultimately it was the soil vapor extraction was designed to clean up organic contamination in the soils, which ultimately by doing that would help the perimeter pump and treat system work a little bit more efficiently. That was completed in 2005. Starting in 2008 and continuing up until the present, the current owner, Bertella Specialties, Inc., has been evaluating in-place treatment of the groundwater of using biosparging, injecting oxygen into the aquifer, and we are in the process of evaluating a potential remedy change for the groundwater portion of this from a containment at the perimeter to active restoration in concert with the other things that have happened at the site. And in 2012, Vertellus, again the current owner, updated the restrictive covenant to include the whole site and updated the enforceability language that we, EPA, has learned over time makes these things more enduring and more long-lasting. So that was put into place, and that's actually in place at present. The remedy components, operable Unit 1, as I mentioned, was a perimeter extraction and discharge to an off-site publicly owned treatment works in Indianapolis, and then ongoing monitoring. I've talked a little bit about these already. Operable Unit 2 was solidification of some sludge materials in the very south part of the site. The southernmost red arrow is a unit called the South Landfill, where, in essence, the site owner filled in a hole in the ground with coal tar waste. And ultimately, this remedy selected solidification with fly ash in order to place a soil cover over the top of that South Landfill area. There was also, as I mentioned, the low temperature thermal desorption of those four other areas on site. Operable Unit 3 was a permeable, a soil and or gravel cover over the area where the wood treatment operations happened. That's Operable Unit 3. and that was primarily to prevent direct contact with the waste materials. Operable Unit 4, again, was the soil vapor extraction in portions of the northern area, and then there were also some concrete caps that were put over some of the areas within the active specialty chemical operations area. That was Operable Unit 4, and Operable Unit 5, as I mentioned, was monitor natural attenuation of off-site groundwater, in addition to maintaining the existing perimeter extraction system. When EPA was originally approached by the developer for this opportunity, there are some key things that we communicated to them. Obviously, we had to maintain the covers that had been put in place over time. We had to make sure that nobody dug into the areas where the wastes were located. We had to make sure that we were minimizing the amount of regrading or site contouring that was necessary in order to put this into place, and then ultimately to repair any damage to the cover soils as this operation began. And that would minimize the exposure to the underground waste. We also had to monitor when the materials, the coal tar materials in the south landfill were originally solidified with the fly ash over the next 5 to 10 years. We tried to treat as much as we could. We probably got about 95% of the material when we actually did the treatment. Ultimately, there is some coal tar that was literally seeping out of that south landfill at the base, the south and to the southeast of the landfill itself. And so the PRP, Vertellas, had to monitor for those and scoop them up and dispose of them off-site. There was a decent amount of material at the beginning that kind of faded over time, and there's very little that is actually seeping anymore. So in essence, we have solidified the majority of the material, and it's staying in place. We've got ongoing groundwater monitoring, and then ultimately we had to make sure that they complied with the restrictive covenant conditions, which are the typical don't dig unless EPA says it's okay. We also had to make sure that any redevelopment would have no impact on the installed remedies, and that not only prevented exposure to the waste materials that the covers were designed to be put over. It was also to make sure that any superficial drainage patterns, again, when we design Superfund remedies, we do it for two reasons. Number one, we minimize exposure and eliminate exposure to the waste materials, and then we also redirect rainwater away from those caps so that we don't have any infiltration or erosion issues. And so this reuse idea had to keep that in mind and keep the existing superficial drainage patterns in place. So through time, we had talked about, peripherally about redevelopment at the site throughout the RIFS process and the remedial design and remedial action. We talked about it occasionally. Never really had anything specific that came up in our discussions, but again, we had, this was not a totally foreign concept for all of us. In 2010, 2011, Vertellas, the site owner, was approached by several site solar developers that were interested in the properties or in the property. And then spring of 2012, Jeff is going to talk a little bit more. Jeff Underwood is going to talk a little bit more about specifically what was put in place to get this going. But in the spring of 2012, the solar project took shape. Vertellas selected a developer, and then they reached out to EPA and said, "Can we do this?" So a lot of the early coordination and interaction talked about, at least from my perspective, talked about remedy protectiveness. You can't dig into the areas that you want to develop over without EPA approval. You have to show that there's no impacts on the remedies that are already in place. And you have to maintain the drainage pattern, the existing drainage patterns, as I mentioned. And then you also have to comply with the restrictive covenants. One of the key things for me, aside from having these initial meetings where the developer Hanwha was very, and the site owner Vertellas were very accommodating and very interested to see, okay, how can we make this work and tell us what we need to do to make this work. One of the other key partners here, at least for me, was the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. They, in essence, were my eyes and ears on the ground. They're located about 15 minutes from the site. And so ultimately what that meant for me was that it saved me a lot of trips to Indianapolis, but ultimately it allowed me to have them go out during a lot of the construction activities so they could tell me what was going on. They could send me pictures, and so I could get a real-time, you know, eyes and ears of exactly what was happening so I could understand the questions that were being asked of me and ultimately make better decisions. We had multiple meetings. We're EPA, so we like to have a lot of meetings. We had a lot of meetings where we talked, at least initially, where we talked about the detailed design that Hanwha had in mind for the site. Very, very clear. One of the things that worked very well here was that all parties, you know, EPA, the state, and the developer and the site owner, very clear on what everybody needed in order to make this work up front. There was a lot of anxiety over exactly what types of requirements that the agency would put on such redevelopment. So a lot of these initial discussions were revolved around exactly what it is that, that EPA needed to see happen in order to make this work. Willingness on the part of Hanwha to be flexible and adapt the project design. In essence, and Jeff will talk about this a little bit more, they completely changed their original design. Based on these initial meetings that we had. They also looked to us for a typical Brownfields comfort letter for their lenders, their financiers, again, so they could know, the folks that were were lending them the money could know that EPA was on board with this project and making sure that, you know, the liability issues were under control based on approval of the various plans and details and whatnot. But in essence, and to Hanwha's credit, they came in and their initial idea for design and construction was a lot of intrusive activities and a lot of contouring of the site, in essence, to make the solar farm, make the site fit, or make the solar farm fit the site. I'm sorry, make the site fit the solar farm. And in essence, what they, at the end of these discussions and as we moved along, they moved the lion's share of their activities above ground, and in essence, they made the solar farm fit the site. So this is not a completely flat site, and they designed their system to take that into account, which minimized a lot of the minimized most of the intrusive work, and it minimized a good majority of the actual soils management. And again, Jeff will talk about that, where there's a soil management plan that we put in place. In essence, it allowed the entire project to be completed in less than a year from the initial meetings that we had through the design and then ultimately into the construction and then ultimately the energization of this solar farm. For us at EPA, and doing anything in less than a year is light speed for us. This included activities at the site during our three-week government shutdown last fall. And that happened, as these things typically happen, just as construction began. So a lot of the things that Hanwha was able to put into place were done, obviously, with the government shut down for 3.5 weeks. Tremendous interaction and cooperation amongst all parties. There was a genuine desire on the part of all the parties to make this work, realizing the uniqueness of this and realizing the opportunity in order to make this a win-win for everyone. We had, on April the 9th, we had a ribbon cutting, an official kickoff of this at the site in Indianapolis. And as Melissa mentioned, Region 5's Regional Administrator Susan Hedman presented Hanwha's CEO with a Renew Award for redevelopment, and that's the first that EPA Region 5 had done. The system itself is online as of March of this year. It's the first in Region 5, and it's the largest in the nation. So again, I'm gonna turn it over to Jeff to kind of go into a little bit more of the details, but this was a win-win for everyone.
Dion, we got a question for you. Dion.
All right.
Okay. Okay. We got a question on the restrictive covenant. So could you talk a little bit more about that and what needed to be updated in it to accommodate the solar project?
It actually, it didn't have to be updated because that predated the design and the construction of the solar development. As EPA does 5-year, we look at all aspects of the remedy, including institutional controls. And it was determined back during the last 5-year review that our restrictive covenants were not restrictive enough. And so in essence, we had to update them to make them enforceable and ultimately to have them to have the confidence they were going to be remain in place over the long term so that we could make sure that the site remedies wouldn't remain in place over the term. And this is pretty typical on how EPA has approached institutional controls throughout our normal five-year review process. So in this case, the update of those institutional controls, it didn't happen just to make the solar happen. The solar came along afterwards.
Thanks, Dion. And I just want to remind everyone you can submit your questions if you have them, and then we can also take questions at the end. But I think now we're ready to turn it over to Jeff. So, Jeff, welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thanks for the opportunity to talk about this project, which would echo both Melissa and Dion's comments. It's a fairly unusual project, but I think one that demonstrates what's possible when all of the interests are aligned. By way of background, I'll explain what Hanwha Qcells is. We're ultimately derived from a Korean conglomeration, so a fairly large $80 billion capitalized firm, which has long been in chemicals and got into the solar industry through that, developing the core materials, and then ultimately becoming a solar manufacturer. And with our acquisition last year of Qcells, where you see the logo there, we became the third largest global manufacturer of solar modules. And Hanwha has undertaken a vertical integration that I believe is unique in the industry. And they desire to have a view of the industry from the supply, which is the chemicals and the modules, all the way down to the demand, which are these actual projects. And so we have a fairly robust development group that's based around the country, largely out of California. We typically look to acquire projects, greenfield projects, and develop scale, what we call utility scale solar projects. And so we were introduced to this project and became interested in it. And we'll start to walk through some of the complications, challenges that we encountered. But also by way of background, I've been in the solar industry for going on a decade, in time trying to develop projects on Superfund sites in the past, and have worked with other companies and other large corporations that have looked at the Superfund issues and ultimately decided that they were unsolvable, that the risks and the liability for these types of projects are more than companies would or should or finance will be willing to bear. So we approach a project with a bit of skepticism, knowing what the history has been, and I think like all of us have been pleasantly surprised to see the final outcome. So as will be no secret to the participants here, and I think as Melissa framed rather nicely, that there is a clear public interest for the use and risk of Superfund brownfield sites. For any range of purposes. Renewable energy, I think, is a particularly apt approach for these types of sites. They typically have a light impact on sites, are typically in the 20 to 30 year time horizon, giving sites time to cure and improve. And there's a multitude of sites that are available both through the CERCLA and the CERCLIS as well as the brownfield program nationally. And so with that as kind of background, why aren't there more development? Why haven't there been more Superfund solar projects? Melissa noted, I think, probably what is the total of projects that have been completed. And in a word, it's complexity. And you know, this chart here is really very faint, so apologies for that, but is effectively a summation of all the various issues that are above and beyond the typical development of a solar project. So our interest is in developing a commercially viable project, and it has its own layers and levels of complexity. And this is just kind of an annotation of the additional issues that have to be dealt with for Superfund project. The clear primary issue here is liability, fear of liability, perception of liability. And What I've seen in the industry is that in the very early stages of project development, especially Superfund or brownfield development, there's an attempt to balance what is the perceived risk. And that risk is balanced by dollars into the project, contingency funds, escalation of typical costs. And when you're balancing a risk that you perceive to be very, very large, the compensatory values become very, very high. And at that point, it's never a commercial project, and projects don't proceed. And in this case, we were able to overcome for a range of reasons here. But so first, you know, with that kind of dismal background, let me tell you what did attract us to this project. Again, Vertellus had been looking for a reuse for the site for a number of years and was had the foresight when the Indianapolis Power and Light solar program was introduced to pursue that, and they effectively completed the very early stage portions of the program development and were awarded one of the very few projects that were ultimately awarded from IPL. And Vertellus came to find that most developers in the solar space did not have the experience with Superfund issues, not to mention brownfield issues, but that financing was ultimately going to be a challenge. And financing is typically where that risk profile really hits the road. It's the banks and the people with the money that have those biggest fears and those largest perceptions of liability. And as a result, Vertellus went looking for an entity that had more resources, ultimately selected Hanwha to pursue the project in conjunction with them. But so what was attractive to us was that the project was still in an early stage. There were elements that we saw that we believed that we could improve on the commercial aspects. We were dealing directly with an owner. There weren't third parties involved. We had some internal resources that I'll detail a little bit more later. But the site status, the fact that this was a previously remediated site and had a long history of monitoring, and there was ample data to review on the site was attractive. And the overall project, aside from it being a Superfund site, the project as a baseline was attractive to us. And so our question was whether we could overcome those liability issues and how those liability issues would be translated into costs to the project and whether we could construct the project in a cost-efficient manner. And I think the typical assumption is that a project is going to cost more to build on these types of sites. There's going to be more delays. There's going to be more challenges. But you know, we decided that we thought with the partners that were involved that we could overcome those challenges. And so really, this is a nice photograph. We had an aerial photograph done and of the site, and it's overlaid of a photo, I think, from the 1920s. 1930s era of the site, where you can see the wood stacks for treating and for drying. What made it possible for Hanwha to pursue the project? I think one of the biggest factors were the partners that were involved. Vertellus was a very knowledgeable owner. They had good guidance and counsel. They had significant exposure to the site, 20 years experience for most of the colleagues that we are working with. For EPA, I can't praise Dion Novak enough for being upfront and center and early and giving very specific guidance and direction, not all that we wanted to hear, but making it very clear what was needed and necessary. And at the same time, making it clear that the EPA had a priority to see these types of sites reused, and that within reason and still with all of the diligence and approval requirements there, that the EPA was willing to be flexible to meet the commercial structure of the project, the commercial timelines of the project, to see it done. As Dion also mentioned, IDEM, the state regulator, from an external view, it's another layer of complexity, but IDEM also was early and often a supporter of the project, seeing it as a viable reuse that had low potential for impacting the remedy. And then we had some internal pieces. Also, August Mack was the our environmental consultant. They were also the consultant to the remediation and to Vertellus. And so between August Mack, IDEM, the EPA, and Vertellus, all of the personnel involved, all the partners involved with the project outside of Hanwha, had effectively 20 years' experience with the site. And that gave us great comfort that they had comfort that the challenges could be overcome. So again, as I mentioned, and the following slides will give kind of a quick timeline, some of the photos from the beginning of the project through the end. But as I mentioned, Vertellus had done its homework before we arrived. They had worked through the restrictive covenant. They had found a viable reuse and pursued it. And then they looked to bring in the right partners. They also had an environmental counsel who gave extremely good advice around the bona fides letter, around how to structure contracts, around where risk and liability is. And again, as I said, where you have that balloon of perception of liability on the front end of these projects, the Vertellus counsel was precisely the counsel that was able to deflate a lot of that concern that would have otherwise been adjusted into some fairly large dollars. And that was all diligence later, but it's not typical to spend a significant amount of money in those very, very early stages and the kind of counsel that would have been required, one, to get comfortable with the project and understand the details, as well as give advice and guidance on it. So Vertellus itself played a critical role. Again, EPA, for those not sitting next to him, that is Dion in the bottom right-hand corner. Again, it was a when we first began to look at this project, it's very typical in our industry to do a risk matrix of all of the things that can go wrong, what they might cost, what it would cost to mitigate those risks and hazards. Part of our process was, what's the risk of having to go through a process with EPA that controls approvals, controls approval timelines, has specific controls over large portions of the site, and can prohibit or delay our project, which also had a couple of time-sensitive deadlines, including the deadline with the utility, as well as some tax deadlines that had some economic consequences. And again, Dion was very upfront, very early. And I'll say the most critical thing, I think, in our view, that Dion did that got us comfortable with the project is that he had a conference call with us early in 2012. It was before Hanwha owned the project. We had not fully acquired it or been attached to it. And Dion may have done similar calls with some of the other developers that were vying to complete the project. But the fact that he took time out to walk us through the project, discuss what his concerns would be, discuss what he thought our remedies to that could be, discuss the time frame to understand the commercial aspects that we had to manage and live with, was a critical factor in, again, kind of deflating what that front-end perceived liability was. Because without that, the mitigation for missing some of those deadlines is catastrophic and typically has at least the ability to end projects. So Dion, and then subsequently throughout the process, Dion remained, as we had met him, flexible and accommodating to meet the standard that was necessary, but willing to find flexible ways to meet the project goals as well. As Dion mentioned, I mentioned, you know, our IDEM contact was almost on the site more than our construction manager. I think he really enjoyed it. Again, people that had spent 20 years who had gone through the remediation on the site, I think were particularly excited to see the site transform. And while we did minimize the activities and the contouring and shaping there, there was a fairly radical transformation of the project site. And so, again, IDEM was effectively the eyes and ears there. But again, also expressed an opinion that the expectation was that with all of the testing and all of the diligence, that this would be a project that should and could go forward. We still had to go through that process, but it gave comfort as we started. As I mentioned, August Mack, there were the environmental consultant, and again, I think for Hanwha, which had not previously done a project like this, was able to give very good guidance on kind of understanding and interpreting the process and giving a measure of what was reasonable as far as, you know, asking for from Hanwha, you know, specific requirements, or, you know, what was too far. And so, you know, it became a very nice fulcrum in balancing, you know, I think, with the agency's interest and the commercial interest of the project. Now, the interesting thing, and I didn't know this until we started to look at the project, is that we had two very critical internal resources. And again, from our perspective, this goes to both understanding the typical EPA process, understanding what that involves, what that costs, what the engagement might look like, but also just understanding the sites. And Matthew McCullough, who wasn't able to join us today, is the VP for development for Hanwha Q Cells, is a chemical engineer by training. And he spent 20 years at Larson's and had completed I believe two Superfund closures in California. So is intimately familiar with the process, the legalities, the contracts, and again, at the very front end was able to push back on what would otherwise just be speculative perception of liabilities that we would be engaging. And so that was critical, especially in early stages and then throughout the process as, you know, tactical issues. And we also had a construction manager, engineer by training, who had spent a number of years doing projects in New Jersey on pharmaceutical sites, none super fun, but had a fundamental understanding of regulatory processes, working with state agencies, and just being able to construct on challenging sites. And you know, he led the effort on our construction design, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. IPL, Indianapolis Power and Light, is the utility that the power is being sold to under their renewable energy program. And the thing that I'd like to say, because this is becoming a national issue, is Indianapolis Power and Light had no intention for any Superfund site to be redeveloped or reused as a function of their solar power project or their solar power program. Instead, they got a dual benefit. The public got a dual benefit of IPL doing what was good and right for IPL to meet their renewable portfolio standards. They enacted a program that then attracted Hanwha Q Cells to redevelop a Superfund site. And I mention that because there's a number of states and utilities around the country that have that same ability, that placing the right incentive without regard for additional subsidies or anything else, you know, have the potential to see these sites redeveloped within the purview of their existing requirements and within the purview of their existing economics. And so this site, this project was completed on a pure project basis. There's no additional financing. There's no additional funding. There's no additional. Dion didn't give us any money, despite our asking often. There were no special concessions. There were no corporate guarantees. This was a typical project that was completed with the same solar incentive that was provided to the Greenfield project across the street. So that meant we had to work harder to make this work, but my point being that there's an opportunity for utilities and states that have solar programs to designate a portion of these for reuse, and I think we could see a lot more of these sites improve. PNC Bank, I'll give them a lot of credit as well. As I mentioned, I'd worked on previous projects where financing agencies and financing organizations simply refused to be involved with the Superfund project. Their perception of the liability was so great and their fear that it had the ability to taint the rest of their operations or organizations or claw out of special purpose entities or subsidiaries and consume the organization was so great that, that they would walk away from these projects. We knew that this would be a risk or this would be a risk factor for the project. We were pleasantly surprised when we reached out to the finance community as the project was nearing final development. And we had multiple offers from multiple entities. There were entities that could not pursue the project because of the Superfund status, but because we were able to go with the level of information, with the level of detail, with some of the solutions that, that Dion talked about, and I'll address in a couple of slides here, we had a number of financing options, and ultimately PNC was the financier that we went with, and you know, also, you know, we'll give them great credit for not pursuing large indemnities, corporate guarantees, parent guarantees, which are very, very typical in the industry. You know, so in the end, the project from PNC was a pure project finance-based project, and from Hanwha's point of view, was a pure project-based finance project. Nothing special except that happens to reside on a Superfund project. So some of the elements that Dion talked about. To give you a sense, traditional solar construction involves coming out, grading all of the land flat, trenching throughout the entire site, driving piles throughout the entire site, driving trucks and heavy equipment throughout the entire site. That's the most cost-effective way to construct a solar system. And that was what we talked about with Dion in our first meeting. And as we began to understand Dion and EPA's preferences and the rationale for that and the conditions of the site and the history and the challenges there, we effectively went back to the drawing board and started to look for an alternative solution, an alternative approach that would address the health and safety of our workers, part of our liability concern, that would still be cost effective, but would minimize the potential that there's any uncovered materials, because we know that there was underground materials, but that would allow us to proceed with the project. And these are some of the elements that, that we were able to use, cable trays, we were able to use posts. We did a lot of testing for being able to use driven piles throughout the site. They're all elements that exist in solar construction, but we combined them in a way that resulted, so I talked over my own slides. This gives you a rough depiction of how much soil is moved on this site if you were to undertake a traditional construction approach. Ends up being 171,000 cubic feet. We knew that'd be a challenge both for exposing materials, but also health and safety, and also the danger of impairing the remedy. This is the result of the construction approach we were able to develop in conjunction with Dion, EPA, with Rotellus, a total of 11,000 cubic feet of total soil displacement. So we were able to take the guidance and the concerns and the issues within the restrictive covenant and develop a cost-effective way to construct the same project with a very, very significant difference in results. And so it involved a range of solutions and equipment selections, but it created a fairly significant greater good. And as we completed the project, we had zero incidents of material being uncovered on the site, which I think was fairly remarkable since we know that it was there. So the ideal criteria, the critical question is, you know, how can we do this somewhere else? And I'll say that Hanwha has both the interest and the desire to do more of these types of projects. And so we have a number of sites under option, brownfield sites. We're in discussions with a number of Superfund owners to see if we can recreate this. For this project, the criteria may be a little different the criteria for this project and what made it attractive doesn't preclude alternatives. And I think as Melissa mentioned, the engagement of renewables, as I've talked to more people within the sector, at the point of closure or at the point of remediation, of having that integrated and pre-planned is an extremely viable path. I think it has a lot of interest. For us, the key criteria for Mayfield was, you know, first and foremost, that there was a market economics that were already in place. So there was a feed-in tariff with Indianapolis Power and Light that provided a revenue stream that was sufficient to develop the project. So that challenges other states that do not have solar markets. I think there's roughly 34 that have solar markets, but probably really only 9 that are truly viable markets or robust markets. So that economics is going to be the challenge for any of these projects. Again, for Maywood, one of the things that was attractive was a very mature site. It was settled. It was known. You know, when we look at landfills in the solar industry, the chief issue is settling, and so it's typically looking for length of time, type of materials that went in. But in this case, and I've heard from multiple quarters that at some level, having a Superfund site is preferable to having a brownfield site, in that the history and documentation and data available on a Superfund site is going to vastly surpass most sites in most states. So we had very good knowledge of the site. We had very good history on the site. All the other issues were fairly well settled. And we had a reasonable landowner that had good knowledge on these sites. But the last item, the controlling agencies gave early buy-in, early direction, and straightforward feedback and direction. You know, to an issue, EPA was accurate on its estimation of what it could do and what it would do. It wasn't always the answers that we wanted, but having certainty was better than kind of having a false sense of security. And so Dion gave very clear directions on when we could expect certain responses and feedback, and you know, we certainly know that we were pushing EPA on timing, but it had, again, the project itself had issues where there was zero value if you missed certain deadlines. The end result was a year-to-year process of taking an entire Superfund site to a renewable energy resource. And I always say first, but I'll put plenty of disclaimers in there. This is the largest. This is a utility scale project. I understand that there's a number of other Superfund projects, solar projects of this scale and larger that are in development and that are moving forward. We were glad to see the project done, no matter the descriptor. And so we don't have to be first, but we're glad to maybe pave a little bit of way in the community to see that this is a viable pathway and others can get it done.
Terrific, Jeff. Thank you so much. I think, you know, while you were talking, we got a lot of questions, so why don't we try to answer some of them? And also, Dion, some of these questions are for you. So why don't we start out? The first one, Jeff, is someone is asking, was it helpful to have EPA issue our guidance on treatment of tenants under CERCLA's bona fide prospective purchaser provision. Did that give you greater comfort on your liability concerns?
100%. And that was a kind of early mid-stage issue. It was one that we were directed to by Vertellus's counsel, who understood that very well. Without that, we would have stopped early stage. And you know, again, to Dion's credit, it was something that as we approached the need for that issue, we were able to turn that around fairly quickly. And I think that also speaks to the familiarity with the site. But that was absolutely a non-negotiable item that was necessary to have effectively the finance, but also legal teams sign off on moving forward.
Great. Okay, and our next question, Dion, they're asking if you'd like to comment on any technical issues regarding the impact of solar panel installation on the integrity of the cap. It looks like from the photos that there were trees growing on the site and those were removed for solar panels. So is this a capped area?
Yes. The area where the solar was implemented is over the southern 40 acres of the site. And so there's a good portion of that is subject to the previous EPA remedy covers. And so as Jeff accurately described, the design and the construction of this was implemented in such a way to minimize any impacts to any of those covers. And again, anything that was the fall and the winter here in the Midwest was one of the most severe that we've had in many, many years, which is typically what happens when you do construction on Superfund sites. But it was so severe that I have to give credit to Hanwha and their constructors for doing this in such a way to minimize as much of the impact as on the remedy covers as they could, and any impacts. There was some rutting and some superficial cover displacement, nothing that exposed any of the waste. But ultimately, they came through and they fixed that as quickly as they could, understanding that they had to make sure that they maintained the integrity of the caps. And the caps themselves were soil and gravel, so they, you know, it wasn't a huge elaborate process in doing those repairs, so that made it a little bit easier, but they were very timely in how they came back and not only minimized the amount of impact on the covers themselves, but also how they addressed any of the minimal impacts that were incurred.
Thanks. We've got another question now that I don't know that there's a answer to right away, but the questioner has said, given EPA's growing experience with solar farm installation, is EPA considering guidance on a presumptive solar farm design for Superfund sites? So I think that's a very interesting idea, and we will pass that along. So thank you for asking that question.
Melissa, let me just interject a real brief comment on that. We have a lot of presumptive remedy guidances for various types of sites, but because the sites we have are so different and the way that you can design a solar farm is so different from one site to the next, it may be easier for us as an agency just to have a number of case studies to show how that was actually done, as opposed to this is how you have to do this particular design on this particular site. Because as Jeff accurately described, their initial idea for this site, what they implemented was 180 degrees from that.
Okay, thanks. We've got another question. What can be done to encourage other electric utilities to offer voluntary feed-in tariffs, IPL's rate, so that more of these projects can be done both in Indiana and elsewhere in the Midwest? So I guess, Jeff, do you have an opinion on that, or do you have some ideas you'd like to pass forward?
Yeah, it's the, you know, the you know, most energy policy is state policy, and so solar programs are directed at the state level and implemented at the utility level, typically through a renewable portfolio standard. And there's typically some flexibility for utilities. I think the comment that I would make is that as utilities are making their decisions, or as market makers are making their programmatic decisions, that they recognize that there's a significant portion of Superfund brownfield sites that can be developed at par, without requiring additional funding, additional support, larger amounts of money. And I believe that preserving a portion or requiring a portion of projects to be developed on those types of sites under those same parameters would get that dual benefit. Unfortunately, the examples right now are the opposite. So the two states, Massachusetts and New Jersey, both considered putting some incentives or carve-outs for to encourage brownfield Superfund landfill development. And in both instances, instead, either dropped those provisions or actually put a deduction to the value of the support mechanisms for solar projects on those sites. So I think it's an education that the utilities need to understand that it doesn't require anything additional, but carving out that program can be a beneficial good.
And Melissa, there are a number of states that have included a certain percentage of renewable energy by a certain date. Not all of the states have done that, but there are some states, and that's just correct, that the direction for the utilities come from the legislation at the state level. And so if the state has said we want so much percentage of renewable energy by so much, by a certain date, that makes it a little bit easier for them to potentially offer these programs. But again, that's a state-by-state issue.
Okay, thanks. We've got another question, which actually I think might be on everyone's mind, and someone is saying, my PRP and the power company want to know the bottom line. Will they make a profit from a solar farm? So, Jeff, I guess we could start with you on that one.
Yes. This is a commercially viable this project. So there's variables. Depends on your state. Depends on the rate of power. All those different things. This is a commercially viable project with above par financial returns.
And Melissa, from my perspective, my guess is that Hanwha would have not approached EPA if that were not the case.
Okay. We've got a question now. Let's see. I'm not sure who the they is. It's Hanwha. Hanwha, have you worked with any oil refineries to install solar panels to produce electricity or hydrogen, looks like?
No, and typically refineries, their landscape are prohibitive to do anything of scale. So this is an 11-megawatt system. It required 43 acres. A refinery might have the equivalent power usage of 50 megawatts, but they also have pipes and conduits and things like that typically running throughout the plant and throughout all their facilities. So it becomes kind of a space value trade-off.
What made this site unique, Jeff and Melissa, is that the area where we have the active chemical operations is on the other side of the site. And so ultimately, if they wanted to say, can we put this solar farm in and amongst the pipes and the tanks and whatnot, the answer to that would probably be no. But because this was an area that wasn't being used by the owner, it made it easier to design and implement.
Okay, great. Why don't we take one more question, and then we'll move on to the next presenter, and then we can come back at the end for more questions. So the questioner is saying, as described, the solar farm was built to fit the so would there be advantages, and would the solar installation have been different if the reuse had been considered during rather than after remedy implementation?
I'll take the first crack at that. Yes. Ultimately, when we talk about any type of redevelopment, if we can do it while we're actually designing the remedy itself, then you can literally build the remedy to accommodate the reuse. And all the requirements of the reuse can be incorporated into the design and then ultimately the construction of the remedy itself. So that makes it, depending on the intricacies of the actual redevelopment, it might be a little bit easier to do it that way. So the earlier in the process you can queue it up, obviously the better it is, particularly in sites like this where we have landfill caps. But ultimately, in this case, one of the benefits of doing it at this site in this way is that these covers had been in the ground for a number of years, So we knew what we had, and we knew what we were starting with, and ultimately Hanwha did as well. So, Jeff, I don't know if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, no, certainly would agree. I think there's any number of things that, you know, there's some economics that are generated by having integrated kind of elements. And you may not have the same cover design if you knew that you were going to have, a 90% coverage of solar panels or whatever other technology there. So it certainly is. On this side, I think, a lot of it would be contouring and development and just placement of some of the obstacles there. But we had a fairly obstacle-free given the length of term on the site. But I do see the value of being involved in the early remediation stage.
And I think it's fair to say, Jeff, that if we, if this had been done earlier in the process, and as you say, the remedy cover could have been designed to accommodate the reuse, that the end result, the picture that you showed, might look a little bit different.
Yeah, as you see from the picture, maybe you can see from the pictures, it's a fairly undulating system, which requires just a lot more engineering and kind of calculations and some tolerances on the equipment. More typically on a shaped site, you would see effectively perfectly angled GPS set post and panels and everything. We took that approach so we didn't have to move as much soil, which could have been done in the remediation stage when you were already moving soil.
Okay, that's great. This is a great discussion, you guys. Thank you very much. I want to move on now to Frank Avasato, who's going to talk about regional seeds and renewable energy. And as I say, we'll have time at the end of the presentation to come back and answer some more questions. But let's move ahead now with Frank.
Okay, thanks, Melissa. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Hi, my name is Frank Avasato, and I'm the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative Project Officer, and the topic of my presentation here today is regional seeds and renewable energy. First, I want to thank Jeff and Matt for their interesting presentations, and I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to hear all about the project at the Riley Tar site. As you've just heard, these stakeholders were very well prepared and very proactive, and they had the incredible expertise of Hanwha Qcells to help move the site through the process. While this story is one worth celebrating, I want to share how SRI can help Superfund stakeholders who may need a little more support and guidance when considering renewable energy reuse. Slide two. In 2009, SRI started to expand the opportunities being supported through its regional seed program, which Melissa mentioned earlier. SRI has provided resources for several projects which we've called alternative energy regional seeds. These projects where the program was able to help communities explore options for alternative energy on Superfund sites by looking at new strategies, specifically pre-feasibility assessments, to evaluate potential opportunities for installing renewable energy systems for remedial or commercial purposes. Slide three. SRI has undertaken renewable energy assessment regional seed projects at over 30 sites across the country. The objectives of these assessments are, first, to inform decision-making about the viability of renewable energy projects as a future land use at a site. Is renewable energy a good fit for the specific property? Secondly, to determine what the best renewable energy technology options might be to pursue at a site. What type or types of renewable energy can be specific site support. These analyses generally consist of first-level screening of information to help the site stakeholders, including site owners and local communities, better understand and prioritize renewable energy opportunities and investments. You'll see on the screen some examples of the assessments at sites such as the Asarco Mission Mine, the Submarine Base New London, the Rockwell International site, and many others. Not all of these sites currently support renewable energy projects. In some instances, the site assessments have found that renewable energy is not a good fit for the site, either from a feasibility or financial perspective. SRI still sees these assessments as a good investment because they continue to protect the integrity of the remedy at the site by showing how the site can or cannot be used appropriately. and also they help the stakeholders interested in renewable energy better understand the process to pursue a project, a better-suited property. Next slide, slide four.
Frank, this is Michelle. I just want to interrupt.
You know, every site is a little different. There is a basic assessment framework used at sites considering renewable energy. First, there is a need to evaluate renewable energy resources for the site and then assess the site's suitability for the chosen resource. SRI reviews the various markets and any kinds of incentives that may be available. These vary widely and can be state, developer, technology, or other types of incentives. After performing a renewable energy technology overview, we begin producing estimates on the system size and output projections. If the assessment is for green remediation purposes, the assessment needs to look at the estimated cost of the site cleanup electricity demand. The last step in the assessment is the preliminary economic and financial analysis to help stakeholders see what options may be feasible. SRI supports these activities because we want to work with communities to understand what the reasonable future land use of a site might be. We start with this baseline framework, but we have the flexibility to adapt the steps in the process to address site-specific interests and concerns. Slide five. On the screen, you will see an example map that has been generated as part of a renewable energy assessment. Suitability analysis generally takes into account the remedy compatibility considerations, use restrictions, parcel configuration and ownership, zoning, infrastructure and access, and surrounding land use context. Analyzing these factors helps to identify and visualize areas deemed suitable for renewable energy projects. The yellow spaces in the map on screen are areas that are suitable for solar reuse. The gray areas have restrictions or limitations on solar use based on the remedial components in place. And the seafoam green spaces are areas with physical limitations when considering solar development. These types of maps can be useful when considering either partial or site-wide installations. Next slide, slide six. The mapping information from the site suitability work also sets the stage to better understand the potential scope and scale of a project. This table highlights how assessment work can give site owners or communities a sense of the scale of the project that could be possible at a site, as well as a better sense of the economics in getting the project off the ground. Please note that these are not final numbers. They represent an economic snapshot in time based on information current at the time of the assessment. The information is shared to provide a reasonable sense of the scale of the project that could be possible at a site. For some sites, additional analyses and modeling can be done to explore renewable energy project development approaches and to undertake some preliminary financial analysis to provide a first-order approximation of a project's potential financial impacts. For example, to a city that owns a site under different development approaches. Next slide, slide seven. Renewable energy assessments are as individual as the sites they assess. For example, the sub-base New London site in Groton, Connecticut was a small base with constraints on buildable areas. There were mission compatibility requirements that the assessment had to consider, and stakeholders were interested in building integrated solar technologies, for example, rooftop solar, solar vent preheat, given the limited area available at the base for a project. Another recent project was at the Butterworth Landfill in Grand Rapids, Michigan. This site first received regional seed support as a reuse planning site, transitioned into a solar reuse assessment project. The city owns the site and is part of a potentially responsible party group that had ambitious renewable energy goals. In fact, the city has set a target to source 100% of the municipal electricity demands from renewable energy sources by 2020. The stakeholders at Butterworth Landfill also had an interest in pursuing a hybrid reuse approach for the site that would balance sustainable energy targets and community recreational needs at the same time. Slide number eight. As Melissa mentioned earlier, green remediation is the practice of considering all environmental effects of remedy implementation and incorporating options to minimize the environmental footprints of each cleanup actions. Green remediation assessments, regional seeds can help stakeholders do just that. The focus of these green remediation analyses has typically been on a very specific aspect of the green remediation strategy, the use of renewable energy to power on-site cleanup activities. SRI regional seeds have helped with green remediation assessments at sites in California, Oregon, South Carolina, Idaho, and Massachusetts, and the project have included Superfund lead sites, potentially responsible party-funded sites, and federal facility sites. Next slide, slide number 9. Green remediation assessment regional seeds evaluate a wide range of technologies. They include solar, wind, and geothermal. The green remediation assessments follow a similar framework to utility-scale renewable energy studies and also explore considerations such as project economics and financial viability. You'll see pictured above, green remediation is being used to restore the wetlands at the Ryland Road arsenic site. Ferns are capturing arsenic and preventing contamination from moving downstream. This green remediation approach has eliminated the need for more invasive approaches, protected adjacent forest wetlands, and are improving habitat through the creation of a new wet meadow wetland. Last slide, slide number 10. So now that SRI assisted with 30 renewable energy assessments, you might be curious what we have learned and what we hope you can take away from this. Well, for one, flexible frameworks and approaches will enable the tailoring of assessment analysis to site context and reuse goals. Again, this is not a one-size-fits-all process. For large-scale projects, stakeholder capacity building on renewable energy technologies and project development can help move projects along. If you have any additional questions about regional seed projects or looking at alternative energy as a viable future land use at your site, please be in touch with your regional redevelopment coordinator. Melissa is going to wrap things up in just a moment, and she will have all those contacts up on the screen for you. We would love to help you figure out how to bring green remediation or renewable energy to your Superfund site. And I just want to thank you for your time.
Thanks, Frank. Let me wrap up just with a few more slides, and then we'll go back to our questions. I want to talk for a minute about some more about our resources, and I also just want to say that it's great to hear about all the success of these projects. As we mentioned earlier in the discussion, we found that sharing examples of successful projects and lessons learned is a very effective tool for promoting reuse. We have a number of additional resources on our website, and you can take a look at a wide variety of reuse planning project examples. And one area of our website is dedicated to alternative energy and covers not only solar, but each of the renewable energy resources. So we have fact sheets highlighting the different types of alternative energy and site examples, as well as several renewable energy assessments. I also wanted to say that another excellent resource that we have is our partnerships, and we currently have a partnership with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the U.S. Soccer Foundation, the Rails to Trails Conservancy, the Pollinator Partnership, and the Trust for Public Lands. These partnerships are a great way to open the door to exploring reuse opportunities and available resources. And all of these organizations are familiar with Superfund and willing to work with interested communities. So I encourage you all to visit the redevelopment partnership pages on our website to learn more about our partners and the unique skills that they bring to the table. We also find that you can support many different types of uses on one site. So, for example, it may be possible to support both alternative energy and gardens, soccer fields, or nature trails. Next. So let me just say that we work closely with our EPA regions, and we're able to facilitate collaboration between the site team and site stakeholders, and close collaboration with our 10 regions allows SRI to identify Superfund sites that can benefit from reuse-related engagement and assistance like our regional seeds. So as Frank mentioned, we have a redevelopment coordinator in each region to support reuse at the site-specific level. And if you'd like more information about an existing reuse project, or you'd like to discuss exploring reuse opportunities for a site near you, please feel free to reach out to your regional coordinator. So if you have any general questions about the material covered in this webinar or you'd like more information about SRI, please don't hesitate to contact me or visit our website. So before we sign off today, why don't we try and get some of these other questions answered. But I want to thank you all today for joining us, and let's see if we can get some answers to just a few more before we end.
Melissa, I think might, while we're doing the questions, I'm going to pull up the survey that we have.
Oh, great.
Okay. Participants, if you could use our interactive survey here to let us know what future topics you'd like to see in webinars, that would be great. And with that, I seem to have lost the questions. Jean, are you on the line when I switch to the left?
I am here. I'm here. So did you need some help closing out the webinar with final reminders?
Actually, I just pulled up the last layout to do the survey, and the question pod seems to not be where it was.
I will fix that.
That would be great.
It all better.
Great. I know you will. Well, not the question pod for the participants. The questions do on
yes,
my
for you.
There we go.
Yeah, we're going to take
all
care
right.
of that. But bear with me. I'm going to actually separate something because I want them. Sorry, guys. You're going to miss something for a moment. It's going to magically be fixed. And then, Michelle, let me give it right back to you. There you go. And so for the participants who are still on the line, if you happen to be in the middle of typing up a question and it disappeared on you, I apologize, but we have returned and restored the question box in the lower right corner of your screens.
Okay, we got it back. Sorry about that, everyone. But here we go. We're going to go with some questions.
Okay, I don't know if this is probably Dion and Jeff, but someone has asked, is there a minimum acreage needed for this type of redevelopment based on your experience?
Jeff, it depends on the size of the redevelopment, but I'll let you answer that.
Yeah, it's really only a matter of economics. The project site we were looking at for Maywood, that was 43 acres. I think the Aerojet that Melissa showed earlier was probably about 5 acres. And I expect some of the pumping stations that are solar powered are 20 square feet. So it really depends on the expectation or the use of it, how much space you're going to need. From a developer's perspective, the larger the better.
And so ultimately, I guess, Melissa or Michelle, on the smaller sites, this is a utility scale where the electricity is being sold back into Indianapolis Power and Light's grid. But ultimately, for some of the smaller sites, it might be cost effective to power, to put solar on the smaller site and then use that energy to power some of the components of the remediation. And on the larger sites like this, it may make more sense to do as they did out here in Indianapolis. And literally sell it back into the grid. So if you have a small site, it may make sense for you to look into, potentially powering a groundwater extraction system, for instance, or a soil vapor extraction or a landfill gas collection system or something along those lines.
Okay, thanks. We've got another question. Jeff, I think this one's for you. They've asked, what is Vertellus getting out of this arrangement? Do they get a lease fee for the land, and are they using any electricity?
Vertellus is getting a lease fee. They're getting use, the land will be used. We have the lease extends to 35 years. What they're getting, I think, as well is instead of having a negative draw for maintenance and expense of maintaining that property, is they at least have now revenue that's offsetting. And I expect some of that probably goes into the site maintenance budget.
But it's typical at Michelle at Superfund sites, the stuff that we do costs site owners money. So in this case, they may be able to offset some of that.
Okay, thanks. I understand that in Region 5, you have an interagency agreement with the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Lab, or NREL, to conduct feasibility studies for renewable projects as well as SCEO, who's a contractor that works on a lot of these sites. And Gary Schaefer has just appointed Tom Bloom as the point of contact for these renewable feasibility studies. So I just wanted to pass that on to everyone. Let's see, let's take a look at our other questions. Okay, which one do you want? Yeah, we did that. Okay, we've got another. How long did it take to clean up or decontaminate the site before the solar project? So I guess they've said VSI. I guess that's for Telus. Yeah.
Yeah, ultimately, so, as you go back through the timeline, and let me just pull up the timeline here, they started their remediation in the mid-1990s, and ultimately it was completed. The actual physical construction was completed about 4 or 5 years later, and now we've got, obviously, ongoing operation and maintenance. So the actual cleanup itself of the various phases that I pointed out before took 5 or 6 years.
And we've got another question. What techniques were
implored?
All right. What techniques did you use in groundwater monitoring?
There are a number of monitoring wells that are sunk on the site and off the site that we sample on a periodic basis to track not only, and these were wells that were installed back during the investigation phase, so we could get a handle on exactly where the groundwater contamination is and was. Initially, this site was listed on the NPL because of a contaminated water supply well off-site. So the investigation, we put a number of wells on-site and off-site to figure out exactly where the contamination was in the groundwater. And then ultimately, we're using a portion of those for the ongoing monitoring of the cleanup.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. We've got another question. For the Riley site, was it necessary to amend any part of the original risk assessment to go forward?
No, because, again, the way the system was designed, the risk assessment, identified risks that the remedies were constructed to minimize or prevent. And then ultimately, the solar farm went over the top of that, and again, as Jeff accurately described, any impacts to the subsurface or any exposure to waste in the subsurface were either minimized or eliminated. So where EPA does, in some situations for redevelopment, we do post-construction risk assessments, which in essence says, now that the remedy has been put into place, let's do a risk analysis and show that the remedy is, in fact, being protective. In this case, we didn't have to do that.
Okay. Somebody said, how many Region 5 Superfund sites have developed solar power for on-site use? So I don't have that answer at my fingertips, but maybe Dion, have you got that?
I actually am working on a site in Ohio and then that Butterworth landfill that Frank showed a picture of, where there is a desire to put solar on top of old landfills. I'm actually working on another site in southern Illinois where they want to put a solar on top of an old aluminum smelting waste site. So those are the ones that I'm aware of.
Okay, and we try to keep track of these on our website. Let's see. We've got a question.
Melissa, I just realized I didn't answer fully the question earlier. The power that's generated on the Mayfield site is all going directly to Indianapolis Power and Light, so it's not going to the site owner. And the state doesn't allow it. That may change in the future.
Okay, thanks. I think that we're hearing that you've got 5 renewable studies that you've done in Region 5. And I think we have one more question. Let's see. In general, what were the design modifications from the initial proposal that allowed implementation post-remedy? So, Dion, maybe that's for you to start.
Yeah, I'll start that. The initial design, as Jeff described, was trenching, a significant amount of soil management and trenching
to actually put the support in place to mount the solar, to mount the solar panels on, the racking that normally goes into place first that the panels are attached to. And then also the cables, and I don't know what the number is, Jeff, I'm sure you know, you have the number of the amount of feet of cable that went into, you know, putting and hooking up these 36,000 panels to, you know, to the actual control building and then ultimately leading off site. And so that typically, that's the most significant incursion into the ground, is they typically trench all of that into the ground. And so what that does is there's a lot of soil that needs to be managed in order to be able to do that, and then everything's underground. And so the main thing here is that Hanwha designed, once we had our initial meetings, they designed everything to be above ground, including the cable trays, so that it makes it, in my opinion, it makes it easier for them to do any kind of long-term maintenance on, you know, replacing cables and, you know, wires that go bad and things like that, because it's all above ground. And so that was the most significant departure from the initial design, was they brought everything above ground.
Yeah, the elimination of trenching, which is all for the wire management, was the biggest impact on reducing the soil movement, I think 80% of the total. It has trade-offs. So the cable trays that Dion mentioned, it just has all of the cables set off of the ground. That's not a traditional approach in the U.S. markets. It's more traditional in some of the European and Asian markets. And the trade-off is you have to have larger wire gauges. You have less insulation that you would get from the ground. So you lose some efficiencies, but those are the trade-offs that, one, we are willing to make, but two, we're ultimately able to make economically. Precisely to avoid, that significant amount of soil disturbance.
Okay, that's great. And I guess, Jeff, we have a general question for you. What do you think are the top three things that states could do to encourage solar power?
That's a dangerous question. I think a lot of my view of the market is trying to find opportunities and avenues to develop an economic project given the set of constraints and circumstances I'm working with. One of the largest constraints and circumstances I work against is utility pricing. Simply the way utilities value their energy. Some of the now pushback against the what's called net metering, of how you kind of deal with the overages you might have on a daily or weekly or monthly basis for a system. And then some of just the permitting and approvals process, which can be expensive and rigorous. But also, as I think the biggest thing, as I said earlier, is for the states that have and continue to develop these renewable portfolio standards, which, as Dion mentioned, kind of have this 20% renewable energy by 2020 requirements, carving out a portion of that to be brownfield or underutilized land would be, I think, very valuable. You see in the New Jersey area, they had to come back 7 years after they started their program to eliminate development on agricultural land because they saw such a surge of greenfield development in their markets. There's better uses and this dual public benefit in most markets that could be had without a premium to the development.
Jeff, you also might want to mention from your perspective one of the big incentives for this particular site and brownfield sites or Superfund sites like this is not only available land but also the cost of the land, which you have to factor into to your overall cost analysis.
Yeah, the biggest issue is that in the solar industry we face is predictability and long-term revenues. Our contracts are typically 20 years. It's very difficult in some markets to have 20-year contracts. There's also ways to structure markets like IPL had done for their FIT program that has a 15-year sequence of revenues that are fixed and firm. And if this same project had been in some other states that have some more complications around developing that environmental value on the side of the project, it would have been more difficult to pursue this one.
Okay, I think now I want to thank my panel again, and I think I'm going to turn it over to Jean Ballant for some closing remarks.
Well, thank you very much. All right, everyone, I'm going to walk through just a couple of final reminders as we close the webinar. I want to echo the thanks to those participants who joined us from around the country. We had nearly 70 people who were able to sign on for today's broadcast, as well as the speakers who joined us for today's live session. Just before we close out things today, just a few gentle reminders in terms of accessing the materials as well as how to provide feedback after today's live broadcast. We did record session, and you all will receive an email as soon as the archive session is available for free download and replay. So you'll certainly be welcome to forward that email on as soon as our archive is posted. Melissa, you guys already talked about the next upcoming webinar in July?
Yes, we're planning it.
Okay, excellent. Okay. Just wanted to move right on forward then. For those of you that are looking for copies of the presentation material as well as other SRI-related resources, we do have them posted. The materials and items will remain hyperlinked from this point forward, so if you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still follow the links to the additional resources or links page and download those materials. I think someone did ask where they could find copies of the points of contact material and information. Again, all of the slides that were shown today are available off the resources page. I would also ask if you could take just a moment to fill out the short online feedback form to help us continue to improve our online deliveries. I do read each and every one of the submissions that comes in that way, so I can assure you if you had technical difficulties or would like to see things improved in the future, we will read and try to incorporate those feedback comments as possible. If you shared the line with multiple people at your individual location, each person can fill out their own feedback form. Once you fill the form out, there'll be a link you can click to let the next person fill out the form. If you're watching the recorded version of today's webinar, you too can still share feedback. So feel free to, again, to follow those links to the seminar feedback form you'll find towards the right side of your screen under related URLs. For those of you looking for training certificates, CEUs, or PDHs, we don't necessarily produce individual training certificates for our participants, but you may still be able to earn credit for participating in today's webinar with your individual organization. I encourage you to fill out that feedback form, but when you do, check a box on the form for a confirmation email. As long as your email address has been entered in correctly on the form, we will send an automated email that at least confirms you provided feedback after the live delivery. So if you take that email along with your registration email or a copy of the seminar homepage and or slides, that's usually enough to document your participation. If you need additional help verifying your attendance or coming up with a list of all the webinars you've participated in, please feel free to send an email to Ballant, Ballant@epa.gov. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's webinar. So again, I just wanted to thank everybody for joining us for today's live broadcast, and hopefully we'll see you or hear from you on a future CLUIN webinar. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live session.